I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today with economist Paul Krugman, who says it's time for a new deal. But first, today the Senate Agriculture Committee is putting the finishing touches on a $288 billion five-year farm bill to try to determine how the government subsidizes farmers. The House has already passed a bill. Advocates say direct subsidies make farmers more competitive, able to weather the lean years. Critics say that's a thing of the past, that in the current system, wealthy agribusiness disproportionately receives subsidies. In 2005, 9% of farms received 54% of the payments, and those farms were all making more than $200,000 a year. Joining us from Congressional Quarterly is Catherine Richard. Catherine, we know the committee chair, Tom Harkin of Iowa, was a critic of previous bills. He wanted reform. Well, we see today, did he make any real changes?
Well, it depends on who you ask. For the most part, the farm bill that they're marking up today looks quite a bit like the farm bill that was passed in 2002.
What happened?
Well, I think that Harkin had a lot of very bold goals for his bill. He wanted to cut subsidies and invest more money in conservation programs and nutrition programs like food stamps. But I think the politics of farming kind of got in the way. There are a number of members on the committee who come from states where those subsidies are really, really important to their farmers and just said, no, won't do it. So I think Harkin, in the end, had to compromise.
We're understanding another aspect of the bill is that the subsidies go more to favored crops like corn, soybean, and that farmers aren't allowed to farm other crops while they're farming those subsidized crops, and that there is an alternative bill proposed by Senator Frank Lautenberg and Senator Richard Lugar, which would replace the existing subsidies with subsidies that can cover all farms and ranches no matter what they grow.
Exactly. Their bill would essentially broaden crop insurance and put more money into crop insurance so farmers could use that to protect their crops, and cut subsidies and reinvest that money in programs that would benefit fruit and vegetable growers, for example, and other farmers as well.
And what's the chance of that bill?
Well, I would say probably not great at this point. There isn't widespread support in the Senate for a measure like that. You saw something similar in the House that had a little bit more support, but in the end, it did fail on the House floor.
We've been hearing repeatedly about what seem like blatant abuses of the current farm bill subsidies. This morning on NPR's Morning Edition, they talked about addresses in Midtown Manhattan receiving subsidy payments, people who maybe owned land that was once farmed, but as the maps show, they now live in New York City, as well as money going to a massive Texas-based hunting resort that also has some acres devoted to cotton. Does the new bill address any of these abuses?
It does, in one sense. In the bill that Harkin and his committee are marking up, there's basically something called direct attribution, and this would be a system of directly attributing each farm payment that goes out to the person who gets it. A lot of the time, those farm payments go out to a food cooperative, for example, or a hunting reserve. No one really knows where the money goes. So this is a way to make the system more transparent.
And just tell us some other aspects of the bill. We know that backers of an immigration bill were considering tacking it on to this one. So what are some other aspects of the bill outside of subsidies?
Well, the immigration debate could certainly come up on the farm bill. Majority Leader Harry Reid said earlier in the week that the farm bill would include ag jobs, which would essentially make it easier for farmers to hire migrant workers. There are a number of other issues involving energy and alternative energies like ethanol and land conservation that could come up on the House floor as well.
And what other amendments might come up today?
There's an amendment by Bob Casey that would essentially prevent the government from using the eminent domain rule to take rural lands away from farmers to build electricity transmission lines. Another important amendment that has been brought up many, many times over by Senator Charles Grassley and Byron Dorgan would cap the amount of subsidies that a farmer can get every year. Currently, it's at $360,000 a year, but they would bring it down to $250,000.
And is there any cap on the other side on the income of the recipients?
Yes. There's a provision in the House bill that says that if you make more than $1 million a year, you would be able to get farm subsidies. And in the Senate bill, it looks like there's going to be a slow phase down from $2.5 million a year in income to about $750,000 a year.
But still, Catherine, as you were saying, this is pretty much the farm bill the way it's been for the last 5 years. When is floor debate, and is it expected to be, cantankerous, or is it just assumed that this is going to sail through?
Well, I think the committee debate today will probably be a smoother debate, but I think that the fireworks will really be on the Senate floor because that's when the immigration debate is going to come up.
Catherine Richard from Congressional Quarterly telling us about today's Senate Agriculture Committee debate on the Farm Bill. Catherine, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, government subsidies for wealthy agri-farmers are part of a bigger picture, according to unabashed liberal economist Paul Krugman. He says, overall, the income gap is worse than it was in what he calls the Gilded Age of corporate barons. It's the Republicans' fault. And just as FDR launched the New Deal and created the middle class that emerged a couple of decades later, politicians today need to launch a new New Deal and bring the wage and wealth gap down to where it was for most Americans in the 50s. Krugman is the well-known columnist for the New York Times. In his new book, The Conscience of a Liberal, he traces three generations of American history and says, not only is there huge income inequality today, but he finds a causal relationship between today's rise in income inequality and the political polarization in the U.S. And he joins us now in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hi there.
Make your case. You know, what are the numbers?
All right. Take a look at the typical family. Compare where the typical family is now with the way the typical family was in the early 1970s. Is that family better off, worse off? Well, you can actually make a case either way, and that's the point. If you look at the incomes up around 16% after you adjust for inflation, but that's because wives are working. A family that, you know, still tries to live with a single male breadwinner is about 14% poorer than it was in the early 70s. It's not clear that there's been a gain. And yet, think about, you know, those past 35 years. We're talking about personal computers. We're talking about the internet, fax machines becoming widespread, freight containerization. We used to have every ship unloaded by guys holding big bags of stuff, right? Mm. So we're a much more productive, much richer society than we were 35 years ago. And yet we're not sure. It's within the realm of argument whether the typical family is any better off. So where did it go? And the answer is, well, the incomes of the richest 1% of the population are up 150%.
150%?
Yeah. The incomes of CEOs are up 600%. It's an extraordinary increase in wealth at the top, which means there's been crumbs for most of the population.
You say that it's worse now than it was, you know, in the 20s. But you, as you well know, people will say to you, but, you know, people now, more people can, you know, even poor people can have a washing machine, or they can have, you know, some of the things we've come to expect that life will provide for us now.
Yeah, we're a much richer country than we were in the 1920s. We're a much richer country now than we were in the 1970s, and yet people are not clearly better off. And this notion that, well, it doesn't matter because everybody has enough. Were you watching TV during Hurricane Katrina? Mm. There are a lot of really poor people in this country, and even middle-class people are, many of them, are just one bad piece of news, one layoff, one illness away from real catastrophe. That's not the way it should be in the world's richest country.
You give an example of Microsoft founder Bill Gates walking into a bar that helps explain the differences.
Yeah. If Bill Gates walks into a bar, the average wealth in the bar is suddenly a couple of $1 billion. But that doesn't mean the other people in the bar are any richer. And that's kind of a pretty good picture of what's happened to America these past 30 years. Average income is up, but it's just a few people.
Let's take a look at some of those salaries. You mentioned the CEO salaries, much in the news lately. You know, give us some of the numbers there.
Well, if you go back, 60s, early 70s, CEOs earned 30 to 40 times as much as the average worker. We're in a situation now where CEOs are making 300 to 400 times the salary of the average worker.
In fact, you quote Michael Jensen, who's at Harvard Graduate School of Business, and who is credited or blamed. You know, he's the inventor of these huge CEO packages. The economic thinking was what? That if CEOs knew that, you know, that their pay was tied to performance, they'd do this incredible performance, and it didn't matter how much they made.
That's right. One of the funny things is that the people who were arguing for higher CEO salaries also thought that politics was holding those salaries down, and what we needed to do was we needed to have stock options and things that would give CEOs the incentive to take risks. I think Michael Jensen wrote that, you know, if we pay them like bureaucrats, so they act like bureaucrats, so we should pay them like entrepreneurs. And of course, what it ends up is that they end up acting like riverboat gamblers.
Well, and we should say that Michael Jensen recently told the New York Times that, oops.
Yeah, I think of him as Dr. Frankenstein. I've created a monster.
Well, anyway. He says he's writing a new book about how his idea went slightly askew, that people were being paid getting the high pay but without the performance. But what would you do if stockholders say it's okay, or if boards say it's okay? What would you say? Legislate that they can't make that much money?
No, it's interesting. On CEO salaries, what restrained them before? Partly it was unions. So if if the government stops being an enemy of labor unions and becomes a friend again, that will make a big difference. Partly it was just public pressure. Congressmen would hold hearings to denounce excessive salaries. They don't do that anymore. If they did it again, there'd be a lot more restraint. Even Ronald Reagan called up, if you read Barbarian at the Gates, Ronald Reagan was concerned that some of these entrepreneurs were making off with too much of the stockholders' money. So I don't think a legislative answer. It's just a change in the climate.
You mentioned the word political, and that's the second theme of your book, not just that there's this huge disparity, but that it has been caused by political decisions. Now, you know this is heresy for economists. They're supposed to be, as Adam Smith said, that invisible hand, market forces. You say no, political forces.
Yeah. Now, the evidence is pretty strong. If you go way back, you ask, how did that middle-class society that baby boomers like me grew up in, how did it come into existence? The answer is quite suddenly. It was created politically by Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal.
We have some sound from Madison Square Garden, which was FDR's speech laying this thinking out. It was on the eve of the 1936 elections. Let's listen.
We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism, sectionalism, war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
FDR, on the eve of the 1936 election, he'd go on to, form Social Security, wage laws. He was called a traitor to his class, but he implemented these programs.
Yes, and he was a traitor to his class. Actually, if you were very rich, you ended up substantially less rich after FDR got through with you. But he created a much more decent society.
How was it taken from the rich and trickled down?
Oh, there were huge increases in taxes at the top, higher corporation taxes, minimum wage, a favorable environment for union building.
In fact, the federal government saw their role as helping unions.
That's right. And so you created a society in which working families had a much stronger bargaining position than they did before, than they do today.
President Eisenhower would write in 1954 to his brother, "Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor law and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our history. There's a splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things, but their number is negligible. And they are stupid."
Yeah. What happened was that FDR created these programs. He created a middle-class society, and people liked it. And the Republicans, after some electoral defeats, especially in 1948, decided to accept it. So Eisenhower went along. Eisenhower was not a big New Dealer, but he was willing to accept the achievements of the New Deal. The society we had by 1954, when he wrote that letter, was unimaginably better than the society we had 25 years before.
That's economist Paul Krugman. He says that splinter group that Dwight Eisenhower spoke of became a movement to dismantle the New Deal. But are the rest of us at fault as well for believing, well, maybe we could be an uber-rich American, so let's not tax them? We're going to ask Paul about that. And later today, Stephen Colbert running for president. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. His new book is called The Conscience of a Liberal. In it, he says the current wage gap is not driven by market forces, but political forces, specifically movement conservatism, an attempt to deconstruct FDR's New Deal from Social Security to wage laws to unions. Paul, you write that this movement, after capitulating to New Deal Democrats and moderate Republicans in the 50s, started a pushback in the early 60s with Barry Goldwater, and their first real victory was when Ronald Reagan became California governor.
Yeah, they organized. They became an effective movement, what actually people inside it call movement conservatism, interlocking set of think tanks, media organizations, political groups. They took over the Republican Party, and they were able to win elections, but mostly not by campaigning on, repealing the New Deal, although that was their goal, they themselves say that, but by running on other things, by exploiting racial tension, by exploiting national security, and so on.
You say they themselves say that. What would they say? I mean, how can you point to that?
Oh, you can find fundraising letters from the president of the Heritage Foundation where he says, "Never forget that our goal is to undo the New Deal and the Great Society, you know, Social Security and Medicare. Grover Norquist, everybody's favorite right-wing, Grover Norquist, the anti-tax advocate. Somebody once said that he's like a James Bond villain who likes to explain his evil plans to his victims. And he once said that he wants to bring America back to the way it was before Teddy Roosevelt and the socialists came in. So he wants to undo the 20th century.
Well, let's just take a couple of the things that seem to have been done, unions losing their strength, for instance. Couldn't you say, Paul Krugman, that in addition, or maybe instead of your thinking, it was actually the middle class that was born of the New Deal that helped destroy some of those things. So people sort of doing well, doing better, and pulling up the ladder behind them.
Well, there's some of that. People didn't think so much about how much these things mattered to them. Most, you know, white-collar workers weren't unionized and didn't feel to themselves that they needed it. But mostly, if you actually look at what happened to the union movement, it was union busting. The estimates are that at least 1 in 20 workers who voted for a union in the early 80s was fired. That's incredible.
But again, what would you do to change that? Would you suggest legislation? Because you call these things norms, things that have become accepted practice, much as they were during what you call the early Gilded Age of robber barons.
That's right. We are back in a period when, you know, we started to believe that great wealth is a sign of divine favor and personal virtue. But, you know, let's put practical policy is going to be about things like labor law and about tax rates. So I believe that norms can make a big difference. But first thing to do is to restore some progressivity to the tax system, to start enforcing the labor law we have and expanding it, not these things.
What about wages?
The minimum wage has proved out to be a very effective tool for establishing some norms, among other things, in the workplace. And we allowed it to erode. Until this most recent legislation, the minimum wage was back down to levels of circa 1950 once you adjusted for inflation. So you can raise the minimum wage. And above all, the social safety net. Having good health insurance is a prerequisite for being middle class. Only in America, among rich countries, is that something that everyone doesn't have.
Might one of the problems be that when FDR implemented his New Deal, this was a class society. You could not move between classes. And now, the people that you're talking to who may not even know how much their middle class status has been eroded, they look at a rapper or a sports star and they think they could be that 1% that's super rich. And
I'm really glad you said that, because it turns out there was actually a lot of social mobility, a lot of chance to move up or down, but a lot of chance to move around in classes.
Was there that perception, though? I mean, was the perception, though, that it was?
Oh, yeah, it was. Remember, Horatio Alger is an early 20th century author. The amazing thing now is that if you really look at the international evidence, Horatio Alger has moved to Europe. The ability of people to move up in economic status has been declining in the United States and is definitely lower than it is in most other countries.
What else might give you hope that this is a time for a new deal?
So much. Again, when I wrote Conscience of a Liberal, I didn't think I was going to end up here, but it turns out that just looking at the voting numbers, at the political science studies, so much of what has happened in the United States really represents race. Republicans began winning more votes in presidential elections. That's entirely because Southern whites switched parties.
And Southern whites switched parties because the Democrats who had overseen Jim Crow took up civil rights.
As LBJ told Bill Moyers when they passed the Civil Rights Act, the South will now be Republican for my lifetime and yours. And the politicians knew that. Ronald Reagan began his 1980 campaign by going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the civil rights workers were murdered, and giving a speech in favor of states' rights. He didn't say any, you know, bad words, but everybody got the message. You know, the welfare queen with the Cadillac.
Right. A perception that the New Deal was a deal for slaggards and minorities and people who weren't pulling their weight.
That's right. It was for those people. And just in general, they got the votes of people who felt that they were being exploited. Ronald Reagan, with the endless harping on welfare cheats, of which there was never very much evidence, that's central to the appeal of these policies. And even so, people never bought into it. When there have been really two attempts to dismantle Social Security, one under Reagan, one under Bush, both times the public basically said, heck no, we like that program.
But you see something happening along the race fissure.
There's a change in the ethnic makeup of the country. The growing Hispanic vote, the growing Asian vote means that we're getting the white males basically is not a winning political strategy anymore. And more uplifting, we're just much less racist. You can just see that in the polling. You can see it in the public behavior. Used to be, as recently as 1978, a heavy majority of the public thought interracial marriage was unacceptable. You know, and now its overwhelming majority thinks it's just fine.
77%, I think, in 2007.
That's right. For someone of my age, I look around and I'm somewhat startled at the amount of tolerance. I thought the Macaca moment, When George Allen used an obscure racial insult against a South Asian, an American man of South Asian descent, was revelatory, not because he did that, because that things like that have happened all the time, but because the Virginia voters would not stand for it.
If there's one criticism of your book, it is that it is such a screed against Republicans for the reasons you've laid out, but you don't lay any blame at the feet of the Democrats, especially in recent years, with the mandates that they've had in elections. Does some of this responsibility lay at their feet, especially from here on for the next couple of years if that mandate continues?
Well, right now, you're looking at people are enormously frustrated over the Democrats' timidity on the war on national security issues. And it's, I'm pretty upset too. Give the Democrats a Democratic White House. Let's see if they deliver.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. His new book is called The Conscience of a Liberal. Obviously a throwdown, a response to Barry Goldwater's 1960 book, The Conscience of a Conservative. Paul, thanks so much for calling in to talk to us.
Thanks so much.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, how will the insurance industry respond to the fires that have destroyed so much in Southern California? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Colbert for president? South Carolina officials are not laughing. That's after the news, Here and Now. In case you haven't heard.
Well, after nearly 15 minutes of soul searching, I have heard the call. Nation, I shall seek the office of the President of the United States.
That's fake newsman Stephen Colbert of Comedy Central's Colbert Report announcing his candidacy for president last week. He's only running in his native South Carolina. He wants to try to run in both the Democratic and Republican primaries. And that actually has some election officials concerned. We'll have more on that in a moment. But this weekend, Colbert told NBC's Tim Russert why he's running.
I think our country is facing unprecedented challenges in the future. And I think that the junctures that we face are both critical and unforeseen. And the real challenge is how we will respond to these junctures, be they unprecedented or unforeseen, or, God help us, critical.
Funny, but will have an impact. Comedian Pat Paulson tried this several times. In the New Hampshire primary in 1996, he got over 900 votes, pledging, if elected, I will win. Here he is on the deficit.
Bring America back like the deficit. I can fix that. Just turn it into a government program, then start cutting back, and then we'll eliminate it in time.
Well, joining us first from Washington, Joshua Green, correspondent for the Atlantic Magazine. And Joshua, you talk to consultants and academics. What do they say about Stephen Colbert's presidential bid?
It's the fun thing to speculate about this week in Washington, because as we all know, the presidential election seems like it's been going on for 3 years. There's another 18 months or so. So Colbert's announcement has been greeted like a breath of fresh air. It's sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card for political reporters who've been following around more traditional candidates. And it raises the question if Colbert is serious about getting on the ballot. And there's a New York Times article last week that suggested that it might be possible to do so. Then if you're a campaign manager, if you're a strategist for one of the parties, you really do have to think about what effect, if any, he might have. So I did a semi-serious article at the Atlantic Monthly's website, talking to pollsters, looking at Nielsen ratings, trying to figure out who Colbert's quote-unquote political base is. And how many of them are in South Carolina to kind of try and devise a campaign strategy and see if he might have any real effect on the race.
Yeah, well, tell us some of the numbers. And remember that he is thinking of running in both primaries. But, you did the numbers and came up with what he has, a little over a million viewers.
If you look at the Nielsen numbers from this year, Colbert has, I think, about 1.3 million viewers. They tend to be young, white, educated, affluent, and male. There are about 12,200 in the state of South Carolina, by my math. This is all done back of the envelope with some help from a University of South Carolina political science professor and another national ad buyer who has all the Nielsen ratings. The shorthand, according to pollsters and political consultants, is that Colbert runs strongest among beer drinkers and pot smokers, which gives you an idea that his effect on the race might not be profound. But probably his largest demographic, at least judging this week, is folks in the media who are dying to cover this and are giving it all sorts of attention. And that, too, can have serious effects on a race.
Well, we're going to talk about concerns about that. But Colbert says he wants to win one delegate. But you point out that, his viewers tend to be very liberal, young people who might turn out in a Democratic primary, but he plays a Republican. So might some people mistake his character for the real thing?
It seems doubtful, but if you really look closely at the Nielsen numbers of who watches Comedy Central, it's not nearly as liberal as you'd think. The biggest block are Democrats, but the next biggest block are independents, and there are a fair number of Republicans as well. So if you look at a state like South Carolina, where you have, voters can vote either in the Democratic primary or in the Republican primary, if you think about the kinds of people that are likely to get behind a candidate like this, that tend to be kind of college students who might do this as a prank, and if you look at some of the earlier precedents, you know, Jesse Ventura and some of these other guys who kind of came out of nowhere because voting for them seemed like a fun and cool thing to do, you could see Colbert being sort of a troublemaker in either primary.
And you write that he might do best as a Republican in a district that has a pronounced weakness for political gimmicks.
Well, you can. I sort of, with some help from political scientists in South Carolina, we took a look at each of South Carolina's six congressional districts. Colbert said on Meet the Press his goal is to win one delegate. So the way you do that is by winning a congressional district in the Republican primary. Colbert is from Charleston, South Carolina, which is in the sixth district. It's a fairly economically conservative area, but it's also the home district for Henry Brown, a Republican congressman, who got elected in 2000 by passing out 20,000 O. Henry candy bars to build name recognition. That suggested to me as a political analyst that the district has a history of kind of falling for gimmicky candidacies, and so they might be open to Colbert, the native son.
He said he's thinking of a Colbert-Putin ticket. Oh, with the Russian president, of course, or maybe a Colbert Huckabee ticket. That's the Republican presidential candidate. A Huckabee spokesperson actually responded saying that ticket would not only win, but change the world and have fun. But seriously, do you think that he would help or hurt any candidates in his home state?
The short answer is probably not. The longer answer is it depends. The one thing that does seem fairly likely is that if Colbert gets in the race and if the media attention continues, then it really will hurt second-tier candidates, people like Huckabee and like Bill Richardson and like Chris Dodd, who are serious candidates. They're not running in the top tier, and they need media attention and buzz to raise their profile, to raise money. If suddenly you have a Stephen Colbert in the race who's much more fun to write about, it makes it that much more difficult to break through in a state like South Carolina.
Joshua Green, correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine. Joshua, thank you.
You bet.
Well, we turn now to Joe Werner, executive director of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Joe, what do you think of Stephen Colbert's running for president in your state?
I think it will add a lot of fun to the mix, but I'm not entirely sure. At the end of the day, he'll be able to be on either ballot.
Can he get on the ballot?
He could. He probably has a better chance of getting on the Republican ballot than he does the Democratic ballot.
Because?
Their chairman has stated that if he can come up with $35,000, he'll be on the ballot. Ours is only $2,500 or 3,000 signatures to get on the ballot. And then he has to be approved by the Executive Council of the South Carolina Democratic Party, which is particularly an older population, and probably very few of them have heard of Stephen Colbert. So, you know, we were just doing here in my office what it would take for him to get one delegate in the second congressional district, which encompasses the University of South Carolina, on the Democratic ballot. And it looks like he would probably need something like 7,000 votes to get one delegate. That's not all that hard to do at a university of 40,000 people.
On the other hand, Stephen Colbert calls his character a well-intentioned, poorly informed, high-status idiot, and he is a Republican. Might he be a Democrat's walking billboard?
Honestly, I think that's where we have the real issue in terms of our ballot, is that if he were on both ballots, he has to be a bona fide Democrat in order to be on our ballot. He can't be on both ballots for our rules. And the fact that he needs to be a viable candidate for the Democratic, you know, nomination. He's only running in South Carolina. How could he be a viable presidential candidate? I think this has been a lot of fun. But if we're going to get serious at some point about this, which I think we are, you would have to say that it's probably unlikely that he'll be on either ballot.
Joe Werner, executive director of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Joe, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Everybody stand. Just a reminder, you can listen to all our programs stream live at the website here-now.org, and you can also download podcasts there. Take us with you wherever you go. You're listening to Here and Now. We know. We spend a disproportionate amount of time talking about the Red Sox here in Boston, home of Fenway Park, the epicenter of the baseball universe, because the World Series begins tonight with the Red Sox hosting the Colorado Rockies. Who? Troy Rank of the Denver Post is here in Boston to cover the series. He joins us. And Troy, you understand, you even wrote in your column today, the Rockies may be well known in the National League, but the team is less than two decades old. In the American League here in Boston, they may need to wear name tags.
There's two problems. A, the Rockies are a young franchise, so most people just have not embraced them or know much about them. And secondly, television did them no favors by putting their game times to the point where unless you had money on it or were drinking in a bar, you wouldn't have seen any of their playoff games. Most people couldn't even get a game story in their local newspaper here to even learn about the Rockies.
Well, we're going to learn about them now over the next several days. And they're only 15 years old, brand new franchise. As you write, most of the players actually came up on the Rockies farm team. Tell us a little bit about them. First of all, you say they got to the World Series by winning a lot. Why? What's their strength?
They won 21 to 22 games. They're the first team to do that after September 1st since the 1935 Chicago Cubs. But it's not a fluke. Their ERA has been under 3. They've hit nearly 300, and they haven't lost a playoff game. I haven't personally seen them lose a game that I've worked in 36 days.
Okay. take one at a time. You say their ERA is so small. I mean, they hold down runs, but they're going to be facing Big Papi, David Ortiz, Manny Ramirez. I mean, these are big hitters.
When they came to Boston in June and held them to 5 runs, in 3 games, the Rockies outscored the Red Sox 20-5 and handed Josh Beckett his first loss of the season, and they held down the big bats of Boston at that time.
Okay, that's right, that's true. You've got some great rookies. The Red Sox have Dustin Pedroia, Jacoby Ellsbury, but you've got?
No disrespect to those guys, but they're nowhere near the player of Troy Tulowitzki. This kid is their Derek Jeter. He's had the greatest season ever by a National League rookie.
Derek Jeter! You even have to mention a Yankee. Keep going.
15 of the 25 guys on the roster have come up through the farm system. Some of these guys have known each other 6-7 years, ever since they were drafted.
Well, what's your prediction? What's going to happen?
I picked the Rockies to win in 6. Would it shock me if they lost? Certainly not. Boston's a great team, and if they hit, they're going to win. But at the end of the day, I'm not about to pick against a team that hasn't lost in more than a month.
Troy Rank covers the Colorado Rockies for the Denver Post. Troy, we're going to talk to you again, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, how about a Colorado Rockies fan? Well, Jason Sindler's on the line from Denver. Jason, to start, I thought we'd both maybe share the memories of our great-great-grandfathers about their favorite teams. Wait, you can't do that.
No, you cannot do that in Denver. You know, in Boston you grew up, but Ted Williams, and he went to Carl Yastrzemski, he went to Jim Rice, you now have Manny and left. I mean, that's history there. We don't have that here, and I'm hoping that this can help kind of get us some.
Well, I understand you're a transfer from Baltimore. Your family there still loves the Orioles. And in a funny way, you were inspired by the Red Sox to make the Rockies your team after you saw Jimmy Fallon in that movie Fever Pitch. Of course, he was a Red Sox crazed fan.
You know, you sit in the car and you're listening to the game because that next at-bat's going to matter so much, and I missed having that, and wanted to give that to my kids.
That's what I understand. You want your kids to have the same feeling, oddly, that a Red Sox fan has, so you're going to embrace the Rockies.
We're going to go to games. We're going to cheer for the team when they say, root, 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 during Take Me Out to the Ball Game. We're going to sing it for the Rockies. This is going to be my team because they need those memories.
What do you do? Like you mentioned, okay, you sing root, root, root for the home team. What else do you guys, I mean, what defines a Rockies fan, or is that still being decided?
That's still coming out. At the playoff game, it was just a lot of, like, go Rockies chants. I think the greatest chant that they have is they play a little clapping sound when Tulowitzki's at bat, and everyone yells, Tulo! It's incredibly loud. I'd listen for that.
Okay, you keep working on that. So then you don't, when you watch television, put one hand over your eyes so that your magic powers don't go to the opposing player.
What do I do?
Yes.
I'm a little bit nutty on my own superstitions. I've got the same shirt that I'm wearing to every game, you know, very much like any other, you know, good fan that supports their team because, you know, their mojo is going to start to drive the team. Recently, where we've been sitting, I've been kind of in a foul ball area, so I brought my catcher's mitt.
Okay.
And I've been just pounding my hand into the catcher's mitt as I kind of clap along. I actually got a couple bloody knuckles because of that. Right. So maybe we have bloody knuckles. That's our team.
Well, Jason Sindler, you know, we wish you well. You know, you might pick up some things, you know, as you watch the Red Sox fans over the next couple of days. They've been working on it, as you know, for 100 years of pain.
Hey, from Baltimore, I understand. We lost Babe Ruth first. And what we have in common is we both hate the Yankees.
Okay, you just won my heart. Jason Sindler from Denver, rooting for the Colorado Rockies tonight. Let's see, who am I rooting for? Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I can't play tourist.
Well, this is not...
a terrorist role now.
It's an Islamic extremist, really.
Whatever.
That's Palestinian actor Bashar Das playing a struggling Palestinian actor driving a cab trying to make it in Hollywood, where, as we heard, he's constantly typecast as a terrorist. The film is Driving to Zig Zig Land. It's one of dozens screened at the first Boston Palestine Film Festival earlier this fall. Another, Leila Khaled, Hijacker, is a look at the legacy of the first female hijacker, the terrorist of the 70s. In this scene, her brother is interviewed by a reporter.
Supposing during any of these operations she was killed, what would you think then, your own sister?
Yes, I would feel proud for that. She's one of freedom fighters for their own land and for their own country.
But the director of this documentary struggles with the fact that her childhood heroine, a hijacker, used violence. Salma Abu Ayash put together the Palestine Film Festival. She is a Palestinian living here in the Boston area where she teaches high school and also struggles as an actress. And she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin, for having me.
So first of all, tell us, how do you define a Palestinian film?
A Palestinian film is a film made about Palestinian people or Palestine, the country.
Now, interestingly, even the title and the way you've just spoken of the territory is controversial to a lot of people. They don't call it Palestine. They call it the Palestinian territories. So given, you know, the controversy over even what to call a place, were you surprised that so many mainstream theaters here in the Boston area, the Kendall Square Theater, the Coolidge Corner Theater, Harvard University, Boston Museum of Fine Arts, co-presented the festival? Were you surprised that so many people got involved?
We were, let's say, pleased by the outcome of us approaching theaters. Let me say, some theaters dealt with this as a business deal. Others who had a more artistic bend and who were familiar with Palestinian cinema really wanted to have a Palestinian film festival and went along with it.
Interestingly, some of them are in notably Jewish areas.
Well, we actually targeted Coolidge primarily for that reason.
And why? To do what?
Because a lot of Jewish Americans, not all of them, are interested in that area in the world, and we wanted to sort of engage them in maybe a dialogue or maybe just to have them see these films and possibly get a different angle on, on the situation there.
Did that happen? Where did you find conversations after films were shown? And
A very interesting thing happened where we had very positive conversations. We were ready to call, you know,
security.
Security, yes. I didn't want to say that, but actually we didn't call them, but we had them on backup. And surprisingly, even our most controversial film, Leila Khaled, had very positive response from the Jewish people that attended. But I do have to say that I am disappointed in not seeing enough Jewish people in our audience. I would have liked to see more. Well, maybe I have to rephrase that. I would have liked to see more debate, if you wish. I didn't check people's religious background, so I don't know who was exactly in the audience. But I expected a little bit more controversy, and there wasn't that much.
Who knows? Maybe that's the, you know, part of the good news. Let's talk about one of the films you just mentioned, Leila Khaled, Hijacker. It's by Lina Makbul.
Correct.
It was screened at the Museum of Fine Arts opening night. Probably one of the most controversial films. It chronicles the life of the first female hijacker.
If it does good for my cause, I'd be happy to accept death.
That is Leila Khaled. She hijacked two planes, one in the late 60s, the other in 1970. No passengers died in any of her hijackings, but many remember the terror those and other attacks caused. The film is made by a woman who idolized Khaled as a child. Salma, did you have any reservations about supporting a film from a director who admired a hijacker?
Well, the director grew up idealizing her for various reasons. One, Lina Makbul is a Palestinian that lived in diaspora. She did not live in Palestine. So as she was growing up, she needed to sort of connect with that area. And this was a woman, first of all. So Lina is a feminist, and she found her character, you know, Leila Khaled's character, very appealing because she carried out a task that usually only men think of doing.
And she, by the way, we should say she found... She not only found her appealing, she found her. She went and interviewed her.
Which, I mean, I was born in Amman, Jordan. I had no clue that Leila Khaled was there. So apparently she lives in Jordan kind of quietly, but she, you know, she did find her, correct.
And we should say that the director, Lina, by the end of the film, has a real self-examination. She questions, you know, whether it was appropriate for her to idolize this woman. You're nodding yes.
this was a journey for Lena. This documentary basically chronicles her diary. It's a diary documentary of going from a point where she idolized this woman to a point where she may be questioning whether this is actually a good action to take, hijacking airplanes. In the end, she struggles with asking the question to Leila Khaled, do you think that you have hurt the Palestinian reputation by carrying out these actions? And the film ends without an answer. She just cuts the film. And a very interesting thing happened in the audience. All the audience wanted to know, what did Leila Khaled answer? And Lena Maqbool would turn around and say, well, what do you think she answered? I think she's making us all think about it. You know, given the historical context, given the struggles of the Palestinians, this is still an action that merits some thinking.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because one thought I had while watching the film, and it might be the same if you were watching a film completely flipped around, taken from the point of view of an Israeli, that you might feel, I'm not getting the full picture. And in that film, for instance, mm-hmm. we see some of the history of Palestinians leaving the land that was given to Israel after the UN mandate. Mm-hmm. But the filmmaker leaves out the fact, and we've heard other Palestinians speak of it, that in that mandate, it was the Arabs who rejected the division. Israel accepted the division.
True.
And she leaves out that part of history. We've heard Palestinians on this program say, maybe that was a mistake by the Palestinians. If they'd accepted that portion, they would have a state by now. And you say that's true.
Well, I think that it is very true that Arabs rejected that division. And I mean, let's face it, nobody asked the Palestinians if they wanted to divide their land. But we've gone a long way. Most Palestinians recognize Israel, accept a two-state solution, and they want to move forward.
But the point is that when, you know, you have a festival with one point of view, did you worry that, you know, gee, we're going to get... You're not worried. We're going to get.
I'm not worried because the Israeli point of view is being represented constantly in the media. Palestinian voices are not heard.
Well, let's listen to one of those voices. Here's Bashar Das again in Nicole Bolivian's film Driving to Zig Zig Land. He's the actor trying to make it in Hollywood, driving a cab. When his passengers ask him where he's from, he tells them Zig Zig Land, and then he smiles as they try to place it on a map. Here are his interior thoughts on that.
Zig Zig Land is a place that has no tanks, no refugee camps, no Bush, no Cheney, no Sharon, no invasions, no collateral damage, no sanctions, no land grabs.
Actor Bashar Das on his fictional country, Zig Zig Land. There are flashbacks throughout this film of him back home in the Palestinian territories, playing cards with friends, having tea, going to acting auditions. Do you hear people say, wow, these are images I don't ever see? You know, I thought everyone was either lobbing or ducking missiles because that's what I see in the news.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, situation in the West Bank and Gaza and in Palestine in general is very dire, but people manage. Palestinians have proven to have a great will to continue with their lives, and so they do. A journey that might take them 5 minutes will take them 3 hours through checkpoints, but they still make that journey. It is very hard now. You know, in terms of economics, in terms of food, in terms of many things with the wall and everything that's going on. But they have a very strong will to survive and to continue and persevere.
And look oddly like other people.
Yes.
Oddly. Salma Abu Ayash was the organizer of the first ever Boston Palestine Film Festival. Salma, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robert.